Before we start today's episode, I wanted to just take a moment to check in with all of you and to ask you to check in with yourselves, because let's be honest, it's been a really rough and emotional few days. We lost someone that, well, I'm not quite sure I have the words to do justice to who she was. Who she was as a human, as a woman, as an activist and a humanitarian, and a literal game changer in the course of human history and the rights of women, as a wife, a mother, and so many other things to so many people. I'm talking about the legendary Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who very sadly passed away at the age of 87 years old on Friday evening. And while the notorious RBG accomplished so much in her life, including becoming the second female justice of only four to ever be confirmed to the Supreme Court, to me and to so many others, one of her greatest accomplishments and an enormous part of her legacy is how she was a champion for women and really for humanity. She spent her entire life advocating for the advancement of gender equality and women's rights, because women's rights are human rights. She stood for integrity and strength and justice for all, and was truly a beacon of light in many, many difficult eras. This is a huge loss for us as a community of women, and as a community of individuals who truly believe that all humans are and deserve to be treated as equals. I think it's incredibly important for each of us to take the time that we need to mourn and to feel our grief over this great loss. But I also believe that RBG would want us to keep fighting. Fighting against injustice in all its forms, fighting for change, and to continue to listen to and learn from one another. One of the best ways that we can do that we can carry on her legacy and work to make meaningful changes, is to get out there and vote. So while I could probably go on for an entire podcast episode or two or three or 17 about how brilliant and powerful and inspiring RBG was, I feel confident that she would rather her legacy live on in the changes that we make moving forward. So for today, I'm simply going to say thank you. Thank you so very much to the Honorable Justice Ginsburg. You are sorely missed and you will never be forgotten. And we will take this heartbreaking moment and turn it into action. May your memory be a movement. Today's guest is a woman who truly inspires me on a daily basis, and one that I am so proud to call my friend, Elsa Collins. Elsa is a social impact strategy consultant and humanitarian who fights for equality in all spheres. Growing up on both sides of the border in Tijuana and San Diego, Elsa brings a unique perspective to the work that she does with organizations that operate on the front lines of many social concerns in the United States today, including increasing voter registration and participation amongst the Latinx community and other marginalized populations, protecting the undocumented, and promoting racial and religious harmony and gender equality. Elsa works closely with groups like Fair Count, Fair Fight, the Movement for Black Lives, I Am a Voter, Voto Latino, She Se Puede, and Harness. She is also the co-founder of This Is About Humanity, a community and movement dedicated to providing support for separated and reunited families and children affected by the immigration crisis, in addition to raising awareness and educating people on how to be allies and advocates for separated and reunited families, migrants, refugees, and asylum seekers through trips to the border and virtual education salons. During my conversation with Elsa, we discuss our shared passion for activism and humanitarianism, the community, or as she calls it, the movement that she co-founded, This Is About Humanity, her upbringing as a dual citizen of the United States and Mexico, the importance of witnessing, how to talk about race with children, and so much more. Enjoy. Hi, buddy.
Hi.
I'm so excited you're here today.
Thank you for having me.
It's funny, when we get ready for these things, I always think about when I first met someone, if I've met them already. And I don't even remember when we first met. I just feel like suddenly we were together and now we're together all the time. Do you know when it was?
Yeah. So we were in like a I'll call it a think tank, but really it was a room at CAA, and they were looking to do like a women's summit. And so they were bringing women in to kind of give opinions. And I just remember you were so eloquent and had so many good ideas. And of course, I was like, I just need to introduce myself to this woman and just know her, even though we didn't know each other at all. And so I introduced myself and I said, I love all your ideas. And you're like, take my email. And I was like, done. Yeah. So this was like very many years ago.
And then we had our first lunch date.
Yeah. And then we were just kind of always in the same sphere of just general caring about the world and about people. And the thing about that space is when you have like-minded people, you find yourself around them a lot because we're always trying to do all the things in all the spaces. So I feel like we were just always seeing each other at all the, you know, caring conventions, we'll call them.
I love that. God, that's right. It was, you have such a good memory, because I was like, what? How did this happen? It was the conversation about taking the United States of Women nationwide.
Yep.
After the first one, the Barack and Michelle Obama, for everyone listening at home, had thrown this incredible event in Washington, D.C. called the United States of Women. And speakers from around the world came, and it was a magical day. I remember standing up on stage when it was my turn to go and give my talk, thinking like, what am I doing here? Like Nancy Pelosi just talked, what am I doing here? It was so amazing. And they brought in women and some incredible men and people from all these different sort of age brackets and backgrounds. And yeah, and then they were talking about how do we take that inspiration on the road? How do we share this with more cities? How do we get, you know, more local heroes and spaces up on stages to motivate their communities? And that's right. That's where we were.
There we go.
Well, I like it. And fast forward to now, you have helped to create and you run this incredible organization called This Is About Humanity, which I've had the honor of working with and alongside. And I've been able to go on a trip with you guys and follow along on all of the other trips that you've done. And I wonder if you can explain to everybody listening a little bit about what This Is About Humanity does.
Yeah, so it's a movement, we like to call it. And essentially what it does is it helps raise awareness around families and children on both sides of the border. So I'm originally from Tijuana, and when everyone became aware that we were separating families and it just was more in the news, I was very motivated to do what I could do, especially when it was around an area where I grew up in. And so it had originally started out as a donation drive, just sort of me saying like, hey, you know, we're going to get these things to the kids. Do you mind? If you want to, you know, you can send something to my house. Fast forward to like an Amazon warehouse. It was, the reaction was so powerful. So along with my sister, Yolanda and Zoe Winkler, who kind of both wanted to do more, we decided like, well, I wonder if people would want to come on a trip and learn more about what is happening. Because it's one thing to feel like you can give and you can donate and that's incredible. But I'm looking for people who want to learn more and become better advocates. And I think once you have come and you've learned, you are so much more effective at speaking on the issue and can explain why certain things aren't right or have very negative effects and consequences. And so we started doing these trips to the border. We've done about 18 and been able to take like over, you know, 200 people, and to really just be in community with each other and with these families and children and listen to their stories and their journeys and understand why this is happening. And yeah, that's kind of what's going on. This is about humanity. So it's, but it's really, it's about, you know, bringing people together in a time where we seem very far apart and divided. Mm. And that's why we call it This Is About Humanity, because it's really focusing on who we are as human beings and what we think is okay and not okay to do to humankind. Yeah,
it's really amazing. And I want to get into the organization and certainly talk about, from each of our perspectives, what you're hitting on, which is, I think, the importance of witnessing. It's the reason that I've always wanted to travel for advocacy work, because to read about something is one thing, and it matters. It matters. Each of us has the luxury now to be able to educate ourselves on what's going on out there. But I really believe that if you want to advocate for people, there's no better way to do that than standing shoulder to shoulder with them. So I think that's a great thing for us to come back to. But you said something that I want to go to first. You know, you're originally from Tijuana. You are a dual citizen. I want to talk about your childhood, because being raised on both sides of the border between TJ and San Diego, what did that mean for you as a kid? What were your experiences like?
I mean, it was... Honestly, I feel so blessed to have grown up that way. For me, and the way the border used to be when I was growing up was not so much an obstacle and a divider as it is now, but just more a symbolic sort of throughway. So for me, through elementary school, I was crossing the border every day to go to school. So it was like a version of getting on the 101 and going to the valley. Instead, I was just crossing a border and heading to a different country to go to school. But it was amazing. You know, one day you could be going to the movies in San Diego, and the next day you could be eating, you know, street tacos in Tijuana. And so I felt very much a blended human. And once I hit junior high, my mom said, okay, it's time to go to school in Mexico. I'm the youngest of five children, and we all had to go to school in Mexico at one point or another. So junior high was my time. So that was an interesting sort of transition, because even though I was living in Mexico, I was bilingual and whatnot, really going to school in a country is kind of the barometer for understanding culture. And at that age in junior high, like, very defined roles between men and women and what was like okay and not okay for women to do and to be accepted, and what were your goals. And so I sort of very quickly, and as humans, we just adapt and we try to thrive in whatever situation we're in. So I was put in the school and I was like, okay, my goal is to literally become like a secretary, marry somebody, and have like, and be like in society, you know? Whereas I think in the States growing up, I was like, I wanted to play sports and I wanted to do all these things. But that was at that time a slightly different mindset. So, and then eventually in high school, I switched back to the States and finished up high school there and then went to college. So it was a lot of going back and forth and leaning into different parts of my personality and parts of sort of what it means to be a Mexican or an American or both.
That's so interesting. So as a kid, when you talk about, you know, the border being kind of just like the freeway, I think about it almost, it struck me when you said that, really what our borders are arteries. You know, the planet is one circulatory system, and this idea that we have these arbitrary lines and supposedly nothing moves between the two. It's like nature, migratory animals, everything that sort of exists in a better cohesive way with the planet laughs in our faces. It's like, really? You think that border means anything? So I had this sort of image when you were talking about it. I was like, oh my God, it's just like an artery.
Well, we share like natural gas between the countries, the waterways, air quality, you know, soil quality, pollution. So yeah. It's really just human beings that have this kind of construction.
Right. So you were living in Tijuana and going to school in San Diego?
Yep.
And how does that work? I mean, forgive me, but I know you are a dual citizen, but how does that, I mean, how is that allowed?
It was a private school,
Got
A,
it.
And then B, at that time when you would cross the border, you would make a line and then you would get to the front and you would tell the Border Patrol agent, like, I'm a U.S. citizen. And that was, mm-hmm. and then you go to school. Now, as you've seen when you've come with us, it's a completely different situation. They've done a lot of construction around the border, put a lot of sort of barriers and obstacles. You have to have your documents out. You have to have a passport to identify yourself. So just little things that may not seem like a big deal, but for someone who grew up a certain way, you're like, wow, this is very intense. And it seems like so many things are happening. So I would cross the border every day, but I would either be like the first person at school or like 2 hours late, because I just never knew how long the border wait was going to be. So it was like such a, but you know, it was great.
And then where do you think that changed when you were staying in Mexico to go to school in junior high? You talk about like a different sort of societal expectation. Where do you think that comes from?
I mean,
do you think it was the era? Do you think it was culture?
I think it was both, because I don't think it's the same now, but I think this is like 92, 93. Mm. And I just remember the very first recess, there was a game of soccer happening and I went to go join in. And after the soccer game, a now good girlfriend of mine was like, you know, like, if you want to have like friends, like probably just hang out with us instead of playing sports. It was kind of like a thing to where I was like, oh, okay. Well, I definitely want to have friends. So, but I do think obviously now like the Mexican women's soccer team is great. So I think it's a little bit of the era, but also sort of that like machista, you know, that's kind of like in the DNA of sort of like society in Mexico, sort of like male-centric, dominating, sort of like male roles and very specific female roles that are assigned and that you need to kind of follow or needed to follow to sort of thrive in that society.
Sure.
Yeah.
And I mean, larger societal implications of that too. You know, you think about our mom's generation where they were raised by women whose only work opportunity was to go to secretary school. And I remember even, you know, entering into college, going to USC, and I'll never forget, I remember overhearing a conversation, which now I'm like, God, that was so judgmental. But at the time, I didn't really get it, where some girls were talking about a group of girls in their class, and they were like, oh, well, they just came to college to get their MRS. And I was like, what? And they were like, they just came here to get married, to like meet a guy to get married. And yeah. I was like, oh, this is weird. Like, I came here to double major. I don't know what's going
on. Right.
You know, but you realize that
there's
just so much expectation for the way women move in the world. And
totally.
Then it changes dependent on expectation of culture and place and inherited ideology and all of those things. So you talked about being the youngest of five siblings. What is it like to grow up in a house with that many people?
I mean, it was interesting because my older three siblings are very close in age, and then there's a 5-year gap, and then there's my brother, and my mom always says I was like a very happy surprise. So I think the typical sort of idea of like the youngest child is the one that gets everything kind of doesn't apply in this situation, because it was sort of like fend for yourself. Like, you know, I sometimes don't even know how I was getting places, because everyone had their own lives and was doing their own things. So I can definitely remember at like age 11, 12 being like, all right, I guess I need to make myself dinner. Like, you know, my mom, it's a funny story. My mom went to go visit one of my older siblings who lives in New York City, and she left my brother and myself. He was like 16. I was like 14 at the time. And she was supposed to go for a week, but she ended up like extending her vacation. And so basically at one point, my brother and I were like, we think we need to go get jobs. Like we literally like needed money. And like, that's how I got my first job was like, my brother went to work at the Warner Brothers store and I went to go work at Express. And because I like literally needed money. My mom was like, we left you enough. And I was like, I don't know that that's true. Maybe my brother kept it. I have no idea. But like, I literally needed cash. So, that was kind of what growing up with five siblings was like, all right, you need something, like you got to go do it. Like there's no one who, and my mom was, she was raising all of us alone. My father had passed away when I was 8. And so, and it was just her. So it was definitely sort of instilling this like idea of you are your own like self-starter, mm-hmm. whether by on purpose or just by circumstance, but we were definitely all sort of like, all right, like we got to do our own things. And like, because she grew up in Mexico, she also wasn't, she knew like, for example, that education was very important and she knew that we should all be going to college and doing these things. But she also was sort of bringing her very Mexican Catholic like influence into it. So like, for me, it was like, I definitely want you to go to college, but like only to the Catholic University in San Diego. And so she was kind of trying to like encourage some things that I think are very sort of like American ideals, which are like, do the best you can and study hard and you'll get far, but also kind of still trying to keep her own influence on that. Although I sort of broke out of that, but.
Your mom volunteered a lot, right?
Yeah, she was a huge, she grew up, I mean, I grew up watching her do things for cancer, for homeless, you know, St. Vincent de Paul, through the church, through Susan G. Komen, through everything, mm-hmm. all the time was like some event that my mom was like on chairing or the co-host of. And she did a lot of stuff around, you know, the binational space. And so for me, I always just grew up thinking that that was just normal, you know, mm-hmm. that you were always just sort of like, look at what you're given and see what you can be doing.
Look at what you're given and see what you can be doing. I like that.
Yeah.
That feels like a good bumper sticker. if Oprah were in the room, she'd be like, that's the tweet.
Yeah, exactly.
Do you see the through line now to the way that service and activism just are part of your life? Because you grew up in a house where it was just part of your life?
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's definitely a through line in terms of feeling that it's sort of like my responsibility based on not just what I was given, but like the circumstances in which I arrived or came into. And I definitely feel like I'm someone who looks at sort of what do I have at my disposal and what can I use to help others. Mm. And I think that that's always been something that I've followed pretty closely. And I think ever since having kids of my own, I felt even more sort of driven to make sure that they're near it and see it and understand it. Mm-hmm. Because I always tell people, you know, what's happening in this world right now is basically a developed version of bullying, right? And so at the very core, you know, if I can help my kids identify that, then whatever's happening in their daily life, they can decide to like stand up for something, speak out against something. If they see something, say something. And that's like a very small way to start, but that I hope grows into sort of a version of like what I'm doing.
Yeah. Well, I think when you begin to plant seeds of, I guess you could say perspective, you know, really clarifying right and wrong for kids, they really do grow into a way of life.
Totally.
And I think that that's so important because it can be really easy to live in a society, and especially one like this, where Donald Trump and his rhetoric and the way he speaks is having exponential, detrimental, and traumatic effects to kids in school. Because kids hear the way the quote-unquote president speaks, which which is so unpresidential, but they hear the way he speaks on the news, and then they go to school and they talk to their friends that way, their former friends that way. You know, incidents of bullying and name-calling and dehumanization and physical assault are all skyrocketing in schools right now. And I can't imagine what it must be like to be a parent in this moment.
Well, you know, it's interesting because before I was doing This Is About Humanity, I was working in the social impact space and had, you know, done a lot for Hillary in 2016. That obviously did not go that way. But I remember after the election, like a week later, at the time, my daughter was five, and she came home and she said, "Mommy," she said, "you know, someone at school asked me when I was going to get on the other side of the wall." And I was like, I mean, there are very few things that leave me without words. And that was a very like clear moment to me where I was like, wow, this is something that I'm going to have to sort of really be mindful of with my kids. I mean, my kids are half Mexican, my husband's black, so they're half Mexican, half black. And I always used to think, I mean, my husband was the one who would always bring up like, you know, we're going to have the talk with the kids about, you know, the N-word and about, you know, getting stopped and all these things. And I always thought that that was going to be the very first sort of like serious talk we would have. So for it to kind of be flipped on me, because you'd be like, it's time to have the talk. And I would say, you know, they're so young, like they're like three, five, you know, I always thought that was three, five and seven. That's how old they were at the time. And then for me to come home, call my husband and be like, you will not believe what Valentina just told me she heard in school today, and be so upset, and him be like, okay, so are you ready to have the talk? And I was like, I guess so, you know? So that's like, for me, was very indicative of, okay, this is like a new space here and I need to be preparing my kids for the things that they may hear, people may say to them, and how they need to be not just armed and equipped with like what is the correct response, but understanding why are people even saying that? Like what does that even mean? You know?
What do you tell your kids when you talk about how to explain to them why people would say such a thing? Like, how do you start that conversation?
I mean, honestly, we really actually started with looking back just historically at, like, we looked at a map and I showed them maps over the ages about how California used to be part of Mexico and then it became part of the United States, and sort of like teaching them that things weren't always the way that they seem now, so they could understand a little bit of historical context. And then talking a little bit, I mean, obviously everything is age appropriate, but talking about like, okay, and then we put a border because people thought that the border made them safer. Here's this wall. And so people want to extend this wall or quote unquote build a wall, even though, as you've seen, a wall already exists.
Two, in fact.
Yes, two, in fact.
There are already two walls.
Two walls that exist.
At the border.
Which, you know, for people who think that it keeps them safer, it keeps people out, it doesn't. And so just sort of explaining to them, like, so this is what this person meant. They wanted you basically to be on the other side in Mexico, but you're born in the United States, so there's no reason for that. But, and then talking a little bit about, you know, this is a way of, he's probably heard it somewhere. I mean, a five-year-old doesn't kind of make this stuff up on their own. And so just explaining about having empathy for them and maybe like that they may not have all the information. And so, but my kids do. And so they don't need to feel any type of way about it, because that statement is actually just like an untruth. And so, yeah. Yeah.
That's gotta just be so crushing.
It was, I mean, again, I can't really think of a time where I was so just no words. The only words I had were like grabbing my phone and just calling up Jaren and just being like, you will not believe, and being so upset, because you're just like, I can't protect my kids from that. And that's like very hard to deal with when you think of all the things you try to do to like set your kids up for success and protect them and help them be the best people they can be, and just be like, wow, I can't, you know, protect them from that. It's a lot.
Yeah. And it's just so striking it's a thing that we already know. But when you think about it happening to children, it strikes me as just, I mean, honestly, it sucks the wind out of my, you know, the air out of my lungs, that we other anyone for any reason. But as simple as the fact that your daughter as a 5-year-old is this little girl who happens to be both black and brown, and because of who she is in the body she was born into, another child is telling her she's less than. Like, I can't believe that we're still talking about this.
Yeah, I mean, I think for me, there's two things. A, that situation really helped me solidify that how intersectional not just my life is, but my kids' lives are, and how I need to be very mindful of that, especially in the work that I do and the things that I'm engaged in. Like, I needed to lean more into criminal justice reform. Mm-hmm. I needed to help relate how, you know, things that are happening at the border are influenced by the criminal justice reform system, how we're detaining individuals and families and children is, there are a lot of influences coming from that space. And so the more that I can help people see that and put that together, that makes me feel like I'm even doing more work, like, for how my kids are going to grow up in the future. And it also just made me think about, you know, my friends who aren't black and brown, who are raising kids and who, you know, ask about, like, well, what can I be doing with my kids? And a lot of times people will say, you know, well, like, I'm raising my kids colorblind, so, like, we don't even talk about race or color. Mm-hmm. And sort of helping dispel that approach as ineffective, because we already have these systematic biases programmed into our whole society. So if you're not doing anything, it's actually being informed by already, you know, sort of prejudicial systems, and they're going to be learning it from somebody else. So don't you want to be the one that gives them the language and the tools to talk about race and to talk about what's happening instead of somebody else?
Yes. Two women who I've learned so much from, who are both incredible educators and women of color, Layla Saad and Rachel Ricketts, to paraphrase, have both essentially said that if you claim to be colorblind, you are denying the entire existence of people of color, and that it is not enough to just not be racist. You have to actually be anti-racist. Mm-hmm. You have to work to dismantle these sort of societal systems that you're referring to, because this idea that we can just ignore the past by saying, like, well, I don't see it. You know, what happened before? I don't do that. Right. It's like, well, you still live in a system and society that has inherited systems and modalities of treating people differently. So you have to work to combat it. And especially with kids, we have to talk about this stuff.
Totally.
What would you recommend? Because I'm sure there's people who are listening who are like, well, okay, I want to talk to my kids about it. How do I start? And especially, like, women who look like me, who are like, well, I'm a mom to white kids. Like, what do I tell them? What would you say?
I mean, I think my biggest recommendation is just, like, look around you and what is in your everyday life. You know, do you have a pediatrician of color? Do you, you know, go get your coffee every day? Like, who are the people who you interact with? And do you have anybody of color in your life? Mm-hmm. Whether or not they're close, proximate, you know, relationship, or just sort of incidental to your everyday life. And, like, are you ever talking about them to your kids? Are you ever sort of incorporating them into part of the conversation? You know, when you go and buy a book about, you know, who was, you know, insert the name, my kids love these books, but, like, are you ever encouraging them to buy the who was Harriet Tubman, or, you know, who was Martin Luther King? Or are we sort of just kind of staying within what's comfortable to sort of your life? So I think buying a book about somebody who you yourself admire, reading it with your kids, talking to your kids about who's in your everyday life, like, who's helping you? You know, do you have domestic workers who are of color, and do you know their stories? Have you ever asked them about their lives? Do you know how they even came here? A lot of people are entrusting their most precious, you know, human lives to these people. And like, what do you know about them? And I think that those are just sort of like very small, specific ways that you can just sort of try to incorporate better, you know, practices into your life about the people who are in them, you know? Mm-hmm. I think people think it's like so much like, do I have to attend some conference or do something? You don't have to make a big gesture. It can be just something as small as like talking to your kids about the people that you see every day in your life, your favorite restaurant, people who are serving you, people who are, you know, around you, and just recognizing them and seeing them and helping your kids see them. Mm. And recognizing that you may not be able to do all the things that you do in your life without these people in it.
Mm. Yeah. I love that.
Small things.
Yeah, but perspective shifts, even if they start small, cause right. such huge, wonderful ripple effects. And I think that those are really important reminders.
I don't know about you guys, but the communities that I'm lucky enough to be a part of are so important to me and my well-being, especially right now. And when I say communities, I don't only mean the people or the businesses in my neighborhood. I also mean my community of family, close friends, my community of colleagues, fellow activists, and of course, I mean each and every one of you that makes up this whip-smart work-in-progress community. But lately, our normal has changed. And we can't necessarily support these communities that are so important to us in the ways that we're used to. And that's been tough, right? We need that support and those connections for so many reasons. But a big one for me is that when we're able to come together as a community, we empower ourselves and each other to make meaningful changes. So how do we figure out how to support each other so that we can keep making those meaningful changes while we're also adhering to this new normal, while we're discovering this new normal, while we're creating this new normal together? Well, I think we need ways to do this from afar while we're safely social distancing. And lately, one solution I've found so helpful is the PayPal app. The PayPal app makes sending and receiving money faster and easier than ever, which means we can continue safely supporting the people and communities that we love. Just within the last week, I've used the PayPal app multiple times to split food delivery bills for some Zoom dinners I've been having with friends and to donate to some of my favorite causes. The app offers so many great options for quickly and securely sending money just about anywhere in the world. You can use MoneyPool to split the bill or go in on a gift with someone or to fundraise for a good cause. You can safely support your local businesses like restaurants or farmers markets by making touch-free QR code payments. And you can support your favorite charity organization or nonprofit by donating money from just about everywhere. I've been so proud over the years to work with PayPal as an ambassador for Giving Tuesday to raise incredible amounts of funds for charity. And I'm so proud to have them as a sponsor on the podcast, because even now, in these strange times, they're innovating ways to keep us all safe and give back to our communities. PayPal's making it so simple to pay safely, quickly, and easily. Download the PayPal app today. Terms and conditions will apply. If you're a regular WIP listener, you already know how obsessed I am with integrating sustainable and eco-friendly products and solutions into my everyday life. And one of my favorite companies that helps me do that while also helping me look super stylish is Rothy's. Rothy's makes cute, sustainable shoes and bags that are carefully crafted with eco-friendly materials like repurposed plastic water bottles and repurposed marine plastic. Now, I know you may be thinking plastic water bottles don't sound too cute or comfortable, but I promise you, they are both. Rothy's shoes are incredibly comfortable, and they have a zero break-in period thanks to their seamlessly knit-to-shape design with tons of chic styles to choose from, which means they keep you looking cute and blister-free no matter the occasion. What I'm really excited about are some of the newest Rothy's styles, which include brand new bags, masks, and their first adjustable sneaker, the lace-up. Vogue magazine calls Rothy's a personal obsession, And I personally relate to that because there's quite a few pairs of Rothy's shoes and now a couple of Rothy's bags in my closet. They're just so comfortable and versatile. Colors, prints, and patterns are always changing, so there's always something new to add to your wardrobe. Plus, my favorite thing about Rothy's is they've kept over 60 million single-use plastic bottles out of landfills and transformed them into their signature thread, which is manufactured in the workshop that they own and operate, meaning that sustainability is prioritized every step of the way. You can check out all of the amazing shoes and bags available right now at rothys.com/Sophia. That's Rothys, rothys.com/Sophia. Style and sustainability are meeting to create your new favorites. So head to rothys.com/Sophia today.
So in between running this organization and you know, being this powerhouse mom and leader, and where we left off sort of in the coming of age story, junior high in Mexico, coming back to high school in the U.S., what happens in between?
What happens in between? It's funny because when I started high school in the States, I was still crossing the border, like my freshman, halfway through my sophomore year. And I just remember being so loving that I was like, you know, I was really into my Mexican self at that point. Like I was digging the feminine and sort of had a little bit of a mind shift. And I remember my mom being like, okay, well now you got to get ready for the SAT. Me being like, oh, does that like matter? Okay, I guess, yeah, I guess I kind of do want to go to college. But I think for a minute, I was sort of thinking like, maybe I should just get married and start working as a secretary. I have no idea, you know? And so I came back to the States and very quickly after like 6 months, like got back into sports and like, but it just, now thinking back on it just shows me, and even when, you know, I'm down at the border now, it just reminds me how children and kids are so, have this special ability to just get into whatever the situation is and make the best of it. So that's kind of where I was at. And I remember my mom said, okay, you can apply anywhere, but you know, you're going to go to the Catholic university. And I was like, okay, got it. But she did say I could apply anywhere. So I took her at her word. And I had applied early to Stanford and then I had gotten in and my mom was like, well, that's great, but you're going to go to, you know, the Catholic university. And at that point, the benefit of being the fifth child was I had my older siblings being like, I think she needs to go to Stanford, mom, maybe. It's like a really good school. And so she was...
It's like a really big deal to get in.
So they convinced her to let me go. And I remember I was so excited and just, again, like being at Stanford felt somewhat like of an international student, but still kind of, I mean, I'd finished up high school in San Diego. So, and I just thought to myself, wow, like I would have never imagined being a child and like thinking I would end up at a place like Stanford, you know what I mean? Mm. And I loved it. And it was, I mean, it's where I met my husband and it was like the best 4 years.
What did you study there?
I was a communications major and then I got my master's in sociology.
Very cool. And did you play sports in college
as well?
I did
not. You know, at Stanford, you have to be like an Olympian.
Right.
You know, I mean, same like USC. Like, I think you really have to be
please.
Like.
Oh, yeah, I don't sport.
I'm yeah, like, no. I was, I liked sports. Obviously, my husband was an athlete. But I very much was just a student. Just a student, yeah. I wish I could have played a sport there, but.
What did you play in high school?
I was a track runner.
Okay.
So I would have run track. But again, like. Literal Olympians on that track team.
Yeah.
So
see, I don't run unless I'm being chased.
Yeah.
Like well, you just couldn't. It's like a special kind of torture for me.
Yes.
I'll box. I'm down to weightlift. Like let's go to a spin class.
Yeah.
I want to go for a hike. But there's something for me. I just was not built as a runner.
Oh my God, that's so funny.
I don't have it.
I wanted to have it. I just
physically didn't have it.
Yeah. Every year I have this like sort of fantasy when we come up on New Year's. I'm like, maybe this will be the year that I become that person who like wakes up at 6:15, makes an espresso and goes for a jog.
I love it.
And I'm like, no, that's a person on Instagram. That's just not who I am.
But this is the thing about running that I just love is I can go anywhere, travel anywhere.
Yeah.
And I don't need a gym. I just need some AirPods and I'm a little Google map to make sure I don't like run off the, you know, whatever. And I'm gone. I mean, I'll go run 5 or 6 miles in a new city I've never visited. And I've just toured it.
It's very cool. I've heard other runners talk about that. I'm like, wow, what is that like for you?
It's kind of amazing. Kind of fun.
I love it. I just love it. So we catch up. You're at Stanford. You meet Jaren.
Yeah.
And then how do you guys wind up in LA?
Well, he's originally from LA. He grew up here in the Valley, very much LA born and raised.
Same.
And yeah.
I love it. I get so excited when people are from
here.
He so
loves it.
Yeah, we have deep city pride.
There's an aggressive amount of pride, actually. and I'm going to just say, like, good on you. But it was the kind of thing where I just remember, you know, again, as I said, my mom being very traditional Mexican, like, she had never even really seen a black person until she was like in her mid-20s and she'd come to the States, you know? Whoa. So I think she was like, what's happening here? And I was like, oh, this person? I don't know.
I think I love her.
I know. I was like, what? Yeah. So I think that it was definitely kind of a big shock to my mom and my family, just being like, wow, okay, this is like who Elsa, when we were first dating now, you know, and when we got married, it was, you know, less of a shock. But I think at the beginning, it was definitely like kind of a surprise. And, you know, and even like now, I mean, we just had our 22nd Valentine's Day. We've been married for 15 years. Even in the beginning of our relationship, because I sort of really hadn't kind of grown up in the States. Like I didn't really like live in the States, even though I was crossing the border every day. There were so many experiences that my husband had growing up black in the States that like I needed to become aware of, you know,
like what?
I mean, like I can remember we would go to restaurants and I'd open up the menu and he'd be like, there are two black people here. And I'd be like, oh, I was just looking at the appetizers. I wasn't, you know, he had already done sort of a census of where we were. And that was like something that he was always trying to point out to me that, you know, and the only Latino here is the bus boy. And so for someone who did not grow up in the States like that, that was something that was not on in my brain.
You hadn't experienced coming in and coming back and forth for school. You hadn't experienced the sort of not talked about segregation that's so common here.
100%. 100%. Because in Mexico, society is so much more classist because really you're just kind of Mexican. There's no real races in this country. You have a certain socioeconomic status. There is a little bit of colorism in Mexico that exists, kind of similar, but not like this sort of how Jaren would look at it, you know? And so those were things that he would mention. And then once we started having kids, he would start to say like, you know, we need to talk to the kids about the things that they're going to face that he faced, you know. I mean, someone called him the N-word when he was in the third grade and he very clearly remembers that. And so for him, it's like, how is he equipping our children the most effective way he can? And kind of, as I mentioned, the incident with Valentina bringing me along and sort of wrapping my head around, you know, okay, yeah, you're right. Like I need, you know, our kids need to be prepared for the double whammy. I don't know which one it's going to be. Is it that they're black or they're Mexican? I have no idea at this point. but yeah, so we ended up in LA because he's originally from here and he thinks it's the best place on earth. Now we're raising our kids here in LA and that's a whole nother, you know, sort of level of mindfulness that I need to be very aware of. You know, because I always tell people, you know, parenting is an active sport. Like you've got to be in it and you've got to be paying attention and you have to be talking to your kids and really engage with them so that they, you know, I think our kids are great. I'm biased, but I know that they're so just aware of what's happening. They know what's going on. And it's because, and I go to bed every night exhausted because of it. But that's what it involves, I think.
Right. Hmm. And what does it look like for you? Because one of the things I love when you've talked about how you grew up is that your parents and your dual citizenship and the way that you were raised, it all enabled you to be, you know, bilingual, biliterate, bicultural. How being here, what does it look like to raise your kids with your culture? Do you guys speak Spanish at home? Does Jaren speak Spanish? Are they going to a bilingual school? Like, how do you maintain that?
I mean, I've never spoken a word of English to my kids since they were born, no matter in public, at home. They only speak Spanish at home. They are bilingual. They do go to an immersion school here in LA. Jaren, I would say, is about 65% expressive and probably 85% receptive with Spanish in terms of his understanding. He's also gone like for 6 to 10 months out of the year for work. So I feel like we can really dive into the Spanish and it's not, you know, he'll understand he does understand everything. But for me, it's, okay, how do I approximate my experience growing up on the border as closely as I can to my kids who are a little bit further? And it is through language. Like, I think language, especially in our culture, is so huge. And so that's why I'm very much a stickler for bilingual and biliterate education, which I feel grateful that they're getting exposed to. And then, you know, just having the conversations about how I grew up, what it's like, you know, going to Mexico, but being very mindful that they have a whole nother culture that I need to be respecting and nurturing. And so Jaren's parents are still in the Valley and I rely on them and on Jaren's twin brother to give them all the sort of like knowledge that they need. They're like, great-grandmother and great-great-grandmother grew up, you know, in the segregated South in Louisiana, Jim Crow laws. And before she passed away, at very young ages, she would sort of give these very long, like, oral histories about, you know, sort of their family, which I feel very blessed that they got to hear. So, you know, it's like, again, an active sport, just making sure my kids are getting all of it. Yeah.
Have the kids been on any of the This Is About Humanity trips?
We don't take anybody under 21. And it's not really because I don't think my kids can sort of handle it, because I know they can, but it's more because I feel like the families and the children that we're visiting would be hard for them to see kids who can come and go when they can't. And so it's just being more mindful of those families. But we have had events here in LA where, for example, we've thrown birthday parties for kids who spent a birthday in detention, but then have since been reunited with family and they now live in the LA surrounding area. And we throw like what we like to call the best birthday party ever. And we invite families to come and volunteer. And so my kids come to that and we've did a big Christmas party for reunited families, and they've come to that as well. So they've come to wherever sort of is like appropriate.
Yeah. When did This Is About Humanity start?
I mean, it really started in the summer of 2018, sort of when everything was like kind of out there, when that first case kind of sort of just broke through. And for me, I kept on seeing people who were, you know, doing donations for these families. And growing up in that area, I was always like, but how are you getting it to the kids? Like, I was always about sort of this, as you say, this through line. Like, I was like, where is the transparency? Where is the through line? And so with my sister, who had been working in government in that space for a long time, we figured out the way to get donations to these families and to these kids. And so then I felt like, okay, now I feel comfortable saying, come do this, because I know we're going to get it to them. That's kind of been one of the hallmarks that I'm super proud of about This Is About Humanity, which is like, you know what's happening. You know where we're going. You know what we're raising money for. You know where the goods are. You're either going to give it to them. You're going to see it there. We're going to tell you. Mm. And so that's been kind of one of the most important things to me, is that people just know when they're supporting us, they're literally supporting the exact families that you would want to be supporting. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it's super special. Can you talk to people a little bit about what you're collecting and why, and what the conditions are for these families who are stuck at the border?
Yeah, I mean, in the past, well, I don't know, maybe like year, ever since we started the MPP program, we've returned about 60,000 people to Mexico, regardless or not whether they're from Mexico. And they're sort of kind of the, you know, the majority are in these border towns waiting for their asylum case or waiting for their number in shelters that have either existed for a long time or have just sprung up. I would probably say now there's probably over 33 sort of like official and unofficial shelters in Tijuana alone. Mm. We work with about 6 or 7 of them. And so we work to help make their lives better in these situations. A lot of these shelters are overcrowded. They are over capacity. The conditions are not great. You would probably be shocked, but know that these people are just grateful they're even there and have even gotten that far. So we usually do, you know, we'll fundraise to, we just finished renovating a kitchen in the shelter that you came and visited. Mm-hmm. And so now that we've done the kitchen, we want to convert one of the areas into a playroom, because the way that shelter is, you know, it's one tent per family, which could be anywhere between 3 to 6 individuals, 45 tents at a time, but there's no real space for the kids to play, and they can't go outside because they're not in a great area. And, and these families and children are very vulnerable to child trafficking and sex trafficking and gangs and whatnot. And so it's really hard because it's not a lockdown shelter. They could leave, but they really can't leave because it's not safe.
And one of the things I remember being really struck by when we went to visit was that criminal operations, in the same way that they work in the U.S., by the way, or anywhere, they identify where vulnerable populations of people are, and then criminal activity in that place increases.
100%.
So by holding these families in these, I mean, what do we even call them? These shelters that are almost like these campsites in the middle of the city, criminal activity is increasing because there is a target on a vulnerable population.
Sure. Yeah, that's, I think, part of also the complicated dynamic being from Tijuana, is it's not common that a lot of people who are in Tijuana or from Tijuana feel sympathy, because they understand this entire situation is making their city more dangerous. And also the capacity fiscally to support this population is not there.
Right.
And so it's kind of compiling all these terrible situations and conditions on top of each other to kind of create this firestorm where you basically have bottlenecked large numbers of people near the border in unsafe and sometimes unsanitary conditions in some of the shelters that I wouldn't be able to even take anybody because I would be concerned about your safety. And then sort of the narrative that has been put out there then is like a self-fulfilling prophecy, right? It's so many people in this one place, so near to us, so dangerous, but all these things that were kind of constructed to make it so.
Well, we've created it.
Exactly.
Because before the policy, people would come present for asylum and then they could go stay with family who would volunteer to sponsor them while they went through their process. And I remember one of the things I was really struck by was learning that somewhere between 90 and 95% of people who are waiting on asylum who live with family never miss a single court appointment.
Never.
You know, these people don't want to break the law. They don't want to miss an appointment. And when we would allow people to settle with family, we would avoid a bottleneck of people needing support. We would allow them to go where they're already supported. Totally. And it didn't require any kind of fiscal planning or cause any kind of fiscal stress on this side or that side of the border.
Yeah.
So the way that we've sort of brought this, you know, gate down, if you will, has actually caused problems that then are being talked about in the press as though they were always there.
100%. I mean, I always tell people, you know, it's like when you want to go to a really popular club and you're like guest list only. And then so many people are trying to go. It's like when we were saying there was some talk that maybe the border was even going to shut down. And when people feel like something's going to become unavailable, they think the time is now. Mm. And it encourages more people to come.
It encourages panic.
It encourages a panic effect. Mm. And so, you know, just over the last year and a half, you've just sort of the trends shift, you know, numbers spike. And then, you know, for me, the thing that I'm concerned about and what I try to bring it back to when people sort of think like, well, is this even a topic I'm like interested in? Or maybe I have no connection to it. I always go back to two things. One, which is when we return people back to Mexico who are trying to seek asylum and who have a court date, where are they getting their notices? Where are they getting their mail? Mm-hmm. How do they even find an attorney? We've kind of eliminated so many steps in the due process. And then the other thing I tell people is, you know, the population in the United States is getting older. We're having less children. And mm-hmm. we are going to be lacking a immigrant labor force mm-hmm. that's going to continue to support the economy the way we want it to.
Yeah. Well, and that's one of the things that's fascinating to me is somehow the reality is being lost in this debate that our country only functions in the way it does because of immigration. We don't have a big enough workforce to fulfill every echelon of society without immigration. And as a native Angeleno, you know, somebody who lives in a city that's constantly in this immigration debate, it pisses me off because I understand that South California doesn't actually have an immigration problem, that we essentially net to zero with border crossings with people. People are coming and going in a transient way. They come here, they work, and they want to go home. We are criminalizing an issue that has been a non-issue here for a very long time. And I think it's been really interesting. A friend of mine was just telling me that they're one of the big winemakers up in Napa essentially was so frustrated by this that they ran an experiment either last year or in 2018 essentially and said, okay, we are just going to hire to work on our farms. Fine. Like you want to see how this goes. We're only going to hire U.S. citizens, documented people to come and help us in the harvest season.
Right.
And they were like, yeah, these like kids from the local college didn't make it one day.
Yeah.
They were quitting by lunchtime. They were like, we don't want to do this. We hate this. And they were like, we're going to lose our entire crop if we don't have people mm-hmm. who want to be here badly enough that they're willing to help do this really hard work.
Right.
And that is not to suggest, by the way, that the only thing immigrants are doing is labor. Like, that's not what I mean.
Sure.
But they're such a part of our labor force, and especially in California, our agricultural sphere is so supported and truly only supported.
Right.
In this way. And it's like, who do you think is helping to feed this country?
I mean, it's not just agriculture, it's construction, it's hospitality, right. It's like food processing. You know, there's so many things that I think, you know, people in the middle of the country who have sort of have this concept of someone's coming for my job, but it's not really the job that you would ever consider doing in the first place, mm-hmm. you know? And so to me, I sort of talk a lot about sort of the economic effects as well as sort of the due process violations, because I feel like people really want to know that safe in their own country and that the rule of law is respected. Mm-hmm. And when it's not, there can be a trickle down effect all the way through, you know, how we treat people like in our own county jails here in LA.
Yeah.
And then subsequently, you know, I mean, if you want to continue to have a thriving economy, if what you care about is economics, then you should be thinking about how we are going to be filling a very rapidly declining labor force. And, you know, it's going to come to a head at some point.
Yeah. Wow. Wow. And you know, you see it even in our denial of visas for kids, you know, whether it's from South and Central America or around the world to come here to study things like engineering, things that are so important. You know, without immigration, the U.S. falls behind in technology as well. So it's every single level. The country is always better and stronger when people come here and contribute to it.
Yeah.
And it's interesting because, you know, for you, I know you're first generation college educated in your family. I know for me, you know, my dad's an immigrant. I'm a first generation American. My mother was born here, but her mother immigrated here. So you can sort of debate, am I first or second, depending on what side of the family, but my family came here. Your family sent you to school here. You know, you became a dual citizen because we love this place and we want to contribute to it. And it's weird that, you know, my family was allowed, but now families are not allowed. We have the resources, we have the space, we're allocating improperly.
Right.
And I think maybe we allocate improperly because we've lost the human quotient. So it makes me really excited to see what you're doing and how you're reminding people. And I'll say, you know, for the bus trip that we went on back in August, just to be with the kids and to see their parents and to check in with them and even just to ask people how they're doing when no one's asked in a while, you know, to make sure every kid has a new pair of shoes and we can go and play soccer and we can visit the pop-up school that This Is About Humanity has helped to build for them. That's something people don't consider, is when these kids are in this, when the migration of their family is halted, so is their education. So how do we make sure to keep some sort of structure to lessen the trauma that they're going through?
Totally. Yes, We Can is the name of the school. And what people don't realize is these families are also undocumented in Mexico. So it's not like they can just start school there either. And so, you know, when you think about what you wouldn't do for your kids to make sure that they're safe and thriving and what these kids deserve, and to see the Yes, We Can school bus there and how beautiful it is and how kids who are in beautiful, you know, environments are going to just do better because they feel better. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's a sort of mental wellness component to this whole situation, which is, you know, what are we doing to kids, to families who were still separating, by the way? I mean, I do occasionally interpret for a psychologist who works with kids who have experienced trauma, and she works with a lot of these families. And 2 weeks ago, I was interpreting, and there was a woman who was looking for her 2-year-old child. And another woman who I interpreted for, who her 4.5-year-old now, but at the time was 2.5, had been taken from her. She had been looking for her for over a year. And when she finally was reunited with the baby and the mom was in the consult, she said that her daughter said, "You're not my mother." And like, I mean, just to hear a woman say that, who I'm trying to interpret for, to help her, it was like, I can't even imagine anything worse. I mean, "You are not my mother" is like just, but that's what we're doing, you know? And I think
traumatizing these kids.
Oh, traumatizing. And now her daughter has, you know, some selective mutism, which is, you know, one of these consequences of traumatic treatment. And I just think, like, that's just not okay. And that's what This Is About Humanity is about. It's saying, like, I don't need you to come with me on all my journeys on how I feel about politics or X, Y, or Z. But if we can come to an agreement that if you hear that and you say that's not okay, then that makes me feel better. And I think that we can kind of coalesce around this concept of how are we treating human beings? What are we doing to families and to children? And you know, and drawing a line in the sand and saying, like, let's agree that we can, you know, say that we're going to support families and children, and let's come together on that. And then let's figure the rest out. But I think,
yeah, the rest can almost wait, but there needs to be a baseline of we do not do this to human beings.
Yeah.
Most of us out here are juggling a million things at once. So being able to offload even the smallest tasks can make a huge difference. I'm always looking for tips and tricks to make my life easier. I mean, who isn't, right? Recently, I started using smart bulbs connected to the Amazon Alexa, and honestly, I don't know how I lived without them before. I recently did a renovation on my home, which so many of you were so supportive of while I was stressing out on Instagram. And while I did it, I was exploring all kinds of smart home technology. I was pretty inexperienced with it. And when I discovered Amazon's smart home and lighting, I couldn't believe how incredibly simple it was to set up and control. There's no extra equipment. You just connect your new smart bulbs to the Echo Dot and boom, you have a whole smart home. Honestly, the first night that I connected them, I felt kind of like a wizard and it was amazing. They have over 16 million light colors to choose from, meaning I can easily change the aesthetic and the mood of my home with just the sound of my voice. And Amazon smart home lighting is also so convenient. The other night I walked into the house and, like always, my hands were full with mail and the dog leash and my phone, and I started putting things down so I could fumble around for the light switch. And then I remembered I could just say, "Alexa, turn on the lights." And just like that, my house lit up. It was like my own little technological welcome home party. I'm really excited that I can finally tell you guys about the very special smart lighting bundle that Amazon Alexa is offering my listeners. Right now, you can get 20% off your Amazon smart lighting bundle at amazon.com/WIP. Every bundle includes an Echo Dot smart speaker and a Senglead color-changing light bulb. That's amazon.com/WIP to get 20% off and take advantage of an amazing smart home deal. It's just one of the ways I'm prioritizing sustainability at home. Oh, and an important note I want to make you guys aware of. Make sure that the WIP part of that URL is in lowercase letters when typed. So that's amazon.com/WIP, because capital letters will lead to an error page. I may or may not have learned that the hard way. That's amazon.com/WIP with the WIP in lowercase letters. Have you guys ever looked at some of the actual ingredients in the vitamins and supplements that you take? A while ago, I took a peek at the ingredients in mine and was honestly blown away by all of the weird additives and fillers that were listed. I went on Google trying to figure out what they all were and realized that there were probably even more that weren't listed. It was pretty upsetting in the moment, but it inspired me to look for a daily multivitamin that utilized only the best and most effective ingredients while also offering transparency about those ingredients, meaning where they're sourced from. And that's how I found Ritual. They've been one of the longest running sponsors of the podcast because I'm genuinely obsessed with the brand. Ritual leaves out mystery additives like synthetic fillers and shady extras that are found in a lot of traditional multivitamins. And Ritual has obsessively researched each nutrient in their Visionary Women's multivitamin, carefully choosing forms that are absorbable by the body. They're committed to showing you their nutrients, where they came from, and why they chose them. They call it traceability. As you all know, I've been using Ritual for a while now, and I feel like I'm still noticing big results in everything from how I feel, like having more energy, sleeping more deeply, and just feeling a bit healthier. Plus, since I started taking their multivitamin, I noticed that my hair and nails are stronger and healthier. So I may be working from home in my sweatpants, but this still feels like a win. And I'm sure a lot of the positive results I'm seeing are because Ritual uses the highest quality ingredients like vegan algae oil instead of fish oil, which comes from the fermentation of microalgae. It's their patented process that leaves minimal environmental contamination. And they use folate in its absorbable form because it turns out 40% of women can't properly utilize the synthetic form of folate, meaning folic acid, which is in other vitamins. So I love that Ritual designed this multivitamin with women and their best interests and health in mind. And I know you will too. Small daily changes can lead to big results. So I'd say start small with a multivitamin today. Ritual is offering all of my listeners 10% off during your first 3 months. You can try it out satisfaction guaranteed. Go to ritual.com/work to start your Ritual today. That's 10% off during your first 3 months at ritual.com/work. Now, when we think about what's happening at the border, you know, when any of us goes with you guys, we are getting to visit shelters where families are still together.
Yeah.
But we know that there are tens of thousands of kids right now who've been separated from their families, babies, toddlers, young children, teenagers, mm-hmm. who, to your point, haven't seen their families maybe from the time they were 2.5 to 4, which is horrifying. What are our options as people who are listening and are enraged by this idea that we would rip children out of their mother's arms for literally no reason other than just to do it and be cruel?
Right.
With your expertise, what can we do? How do we advocate on this stuff?
Well, I think A is to realize that your voice is so powerful. The whole reason why we even were able to kind of expose what was happening is because regular people who found out about it were like, that is not okay. Mm-hmm. You know, it wasn't just the people with the loudest voices or the people that we expect to hear from, but it was regular mothers and fathers and human beings all across the country who said, like, I'm not okay with that. That is not okay. So A, feeling comfortable to continue talking about how you're not okay with that, I think is hugely important. B, I think if you want to get more engaged, you can go to immigrationadvocates.org, and it's a website. It's nationwide, and it basically, you can put in your location and it tells you who is doing pro bono legal services all around the country. If you have a second language, they do look for interpreters to volunteer, but they also just look for English speakers to volunteer, show up, drive people to court, even like start a backpack drive if you want. I think that, you know, it doesn't have to be like, you don't need to go start your own organization. It can be something as simple as that. If that even sounds too much, I always tell people, you know, having a conversation with your kids, that's invaluable to me. Talking to your kids about what's going on. And I hear you. A lot of people think this is a very scary topic and they don't want to traumatize their kids. And obviously everything at an age appropriate level. But I'm interested in you helping your kids develop their empathy muscle. It needs to be exercised. They need to know how to say, God, if that happened to me, how would I feel? Because that is how everyone who's listening hopefully feels, like some of the things that I've said that affected them. It's because you imagine, like, how would that feel if it were you or your child? Yeah. And when we sort of don't let people or teach people how to have empathy, they're able to just not feel any way about that. So having a conversation with your kids is hugely important. And then the last thing I'll say is, you know, you can visit This Is About Humanity and look at different ways that you can engage there, but also look in your own lives. I guarantee you there are people in your life, whether they're working for you, their friends, people in school, classmates, colleagues, who 100% are being affected by this crisis, whether they themselves are undocumented, are part of a mixed status family, went through asylum, or getting their papers themselves. I think that you who are listening probably haven't been looking around very much. And I think if you do, you will see that there are friends and people in your own life that you could be advocating better for. And I think, you know, I mean, obviously looking and seeing like who's making decisions that are affecting these families is huge. You know, I think the more you know, the better you'll do. And so, you know, read up on who's running for local office and who's making certain decisions, and think about, you know, are they, you know, keeping humanity and families in the forefront of their mind or not? Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. those are some ways.
If you could change one thing about the way the media is covering this, what do you think it would be?
The narrative that's out there, and I see this in a lot of different, you know, sort of arenas, but, you know, the narrative that's out there is that people who are coming are scary, they may be criminals, and we don't have the capacity for them. And I think, to me, it's like, have you even been down there? Like, do you even know who's there? I mean, you saw, these are families and women and children who are fleeing unspeakable horrors and violence in their home countries. You're seeing a lot of, I think, haven't necessarily been called so yet, but will be soon, a lot of climate change refugees. You see people who can't, you know, harvest in their home countries anymore because of the climate change, can't make a living, and are being pushed out. And so I always tell people, like, maybe immigration is not your issue, but if climate change is your issue, you should definitely care about what's happening. Maybe immigration isn't your issue, but if you care about LGBTQ issues, those are the most vulnerable people who are trying to come to this country, who are suffering even horrors upon horrors. You know, if you care about criminal justice reform, you should definitely care about immigration, because we're instituting some of these same processes and procedures in this space. And so for me, it's, the narrative is incorrect because we're not really reflecting the positive things that immigrants are bringing into this country, how we're preventing those immigrants from being able to be here and contribute to the economy, and who are the people who are really coming, and are they really sort of scary and problematic, or are they people who you would be happy to have here because you know how hard they would work and you know how much they would be giving back and contributing.
When we, because you touched on this a bit, voting is such a power that we have, and we clearly need to be voting for people who do not support policies like this. If you wouldn't want your child to be taken from you, you need to vote against someone's child being taken from them, period, end of story. You know, as the adage goes, when they came for these people, I didn't speak up because I wasn't one of those people. And then when they came for the people over there, I didn't speak up because I wasn't over there. And then when they came for me, there was nobody left to speak up for me. We have to advocate for each other. And I'm curious, as we approach the election, how would you say we differentiate between candidates who really want to fix what's happening rather than exploit it or use it as a talking point?
I mean, I think it's, well, A, I just want to say that, you know, This Is About Humanity is all about humanity. But I think, I don't want people to get confused and think that voting is political, because voting is not political. Voting is exercising your right in this civic society that we live in and that we should be doing. And so to me, I always feel like when the voting conversation comes up, they're like, well, I thought that, you know, we weren't going to get political. I'm like, it's not even about getting political. It's about your responsibility as a citizen of this country that those people at the border would die to be doing. They would, you know, there's so many people in this country who are undocumented, who pay taxes, who live here, who would die to be able to vote, right? And you not voting is kind of throwing that in all those people's faces who are contributing to your Social Security and to your benefits and to your public school.
And that's such a big thing that I always want to hammer home, is that undocumented people pay billions of dollars a year into the U.S. economy and can never take any of that money out the way that citizens do.
Yeah.
And the economy would literally collapse without the taxation of undocumented people. And there's this narrative that these people come here and they take, and, you know, they take money out of the economy, and they literally don't. They just pay into it.
Yeah. So for me, I think, A, just let's start there, which is voting is not political. It's really your civic duty. And I think, you know, as we get closer to the election, obviously I'm listening to what everyone is saying around immigration. And I think, you know, I don't want to say anything is better than this, but almost anything is better than this at this point. And I think that, And I don't think it's going to be that if someone else is elected, that this situation is going to get solved immediately, because this is a very complicated situation that's going to take very many years to untangle. But I would say that, you know, listen to what people say around not just immigration, but around education and around the economy and around jobs and around school, because all of that is, it's a whole package. You know, I mean, you may have your issue, and I would say, I think issue voting is great, because at least you're being pulled in a certain way and you can feel very good about how your issue is being talked about. But the immigration issue, in my mind, is so intertwined with so many other ones that it's like, great, I want to hear what you're saying about what's happening at the border, but I also want to hear about how you're talking about the economy and how you're talking about undocumented people in this country and how you're talking about education and college and, you know, college debt, because all of those things are affecting all people in that space.
I heard the most amazing thing. It was actually a tweet that I read yesterday, and somebody said, they said, here's how I look at the student loan debt argument. My two grandmothers died of cancer. Now there's a treatment to cure that cancer, but I don't think anybody should get to have it because it won't bring my grandmothers back. And they were like, that's what you're saying about student loan debt. Like, my family suffered having to pay all these bills, so I don't want anybody else not to suffer it. And I thought it was such a brilliant way to look at it. You know, our whole purpose here on this earth, I believe, is to constantly do better so that we can change policies and practices so that people's lives get better and the things that they need get more accessible. And this idea that because something wasn't accessible to me means it shouldn't be accessible to other people, that seems to be the ideology that's out there winning the votes right now. And I think if we can all wake up to your point and realize that the powers that be have politicized voting in such a way. And actually what voting is each of us being able to put our hand on the wheel that steers the ship, and we either steer it faster toward the iceberg or we steer it away. That's it. Like, do you want to be on a crash course for certain disaster when you see policies that are disastrous being enacted, like they'll come for you eventually.
Yep.
Or do you want to steer away from it and remain in open ocean and go on a journey together? And that's what I think voting can be.
Yeah. I mean, I think the thing I would add to that is this idea that we feel like this pie is finite and my slice of the pie, if there are other people involved, get smaller and smaller. Mm-hmm. Wherein in fact, I'm like, no, they're adding more ingredients to your pie. Yeah. And so if we can sort of understand that we're like in this world together on one planet, and that we cannot live in an isolationist me and mine, but we have to, you know, join hands and say like, we're better together.
Yes. And this idea of the pie, I love. It's an analogy I use a lot when I talk about these things. We do. We have this idea like that this circle is it, and I'm either going to have a bigger slice or a smaller slice. But what we're missing is that the circle can actually grow outward. The pie can get bigger, so everyone can have bigger slices. More and more people can have bigger slices. And I got to interview someone recently, and we were talking about the economics of gender parity and how if we could create gender parity in the workplace and women could be paid as much as men in the US economy, that wouldn't mean men's salaries would get lower so women's salaries would get higher. It means that the economy would grow by $2.2 trillion. So the pie would actually get exponentially bigger. So everybody would have more to eat.
Yeah.
And that's something I think we need to constantly be talking about too, is that if we actually allowed people to participate in the economy, if we actually allowed everyone in America to have access to resources and their lives got better, the economy would grow.
Right.
Everybody would be doing better.
Yeah.
And it wouldn't need to be this like, let's give tax breaks to billionaires and screw over healthcare for other people. It's like, if everyone had healthcare, everyone would actually work better. And then the billionaires' bottom line, the people who own the companies, their bottom line would go up while all of their employees' bottom lines went up also. And so I think about how we have the privilege, to your point, about voting for policies that would actually better everybody. And if we voted in the interest of, you know, to quote scripture, the least among us, we would actually elevate everyone. And that feels like a superpower that any of us can tap into.
Yeah.
But we just have to get our perspective right about what we're doing and why we're doing it.
Yep.
When you think about perspective, and I guess maybe because we've just been talking about your whole story, has there been a perspective shift, or was there kind of an aha moment when your mom became a citizen recently?
First of all, I want to relive that day every day. You know, it was interesting because she, you know, has 5 American-born children, has, you know, encouraged us from the beginning to give back, to be educated, to contribute to society, which we're all doing. And, you know, even in her journey, which, you know, she started with becoming a permanent resident and then finally citizenship, still took 8 to 10 years. You know, it still took quite a long time. And we have a sister who's an attorney. I mean, it wasn't, so we had all of the things going her way. But yeah, it was kind of this moment where, you know, she was studying for her test, and now you can study on your computer and it'll ask you like, how long is a congressman in office for? You know, and so she would be studying and my 7-year-old son would be like in her room and he'd be like, you know, like 8 years. And then I'd be like, why are you listening to my 7-year-old? Like, mom, just study, you know? And so it was kind of this journey that my children and I went on with her. And when her day finally came, you know, I didn't think I would be as emotional as I was. We went down, her ceremony was in San Diego. And, you know, they're kind of down. There was like 587 people that day. And, you know, they kind of go through every country that's represented and they like the person stands up. So when they get to Mexico, there was a lot of people from Mexico and she kind of stood up, was just like waving this flag. And I was just like, oh my God, I'm so emotional. Just about knowing that like she's here for good now. She's protected. Mm-hmm. And that's something that I feel like is slightly an effect of the world that we live in now, where I'm like, I don't know if you're protected, even if you have a green card or you are a permanent resident. Like that, like to me, that citizenship was like, she's safe and she's good. And then after, you know, we had brunch and I was asking my mom, you know, so what are you most excited about, you know, now that you have your citizenship? And she literally said, I am so excited to go vote. And I was like, what? Like, that was actually surprising to me. And she said, you know, I've been in, you know, in this country and I've had a relationship with this country for, you know, over 50 years and have never been able to have an opinion about what happens. And now she's so excited to vote. That's what's so like beautiful about the moment, which is like to see that sort of like newfound love for, you know, voting and being a citizen. And she got her passport and she showed it to me and then we registered her to vote together. And she was just like, that's what it really should be about. That sort of like joy and love for being a part of this country and the excitement that comes with it and the ability to like, you know, say like with my vote, this is how I feel. I think was, you know, I think in this space, we sort of get kind of like, okay, we're so task oriented and like, we got to try to do this and and it's like, I forgot that like, it's really about that, this like joy of a 74-year-old woman being able to vote for the first time and how excited she is and being like, I need to remember how exciting that is and feel that way every time. Yeah. You know what I mean? It was amazing. So the timing was so interesting just with everything I'm doing with This Is About Humanity and with stuff that's happening at the border and just like my own personal story, just feeling like she's just good forever now. I don't know.
Oh, I love it. So, as you know, the podcast is called Work in Progress.
Yeah.
And I love to ask everyone I get to sit across from what feels like a work in progress in your life right now.
You know, I think understanding what balance means to me is always going to be a work in progress. you know, because I'm someone who is doing so many things. And sometimes I feel like, God, all the things I'm doing, am I even doing them at 50%? Mm-hmm. Am I like being a good enough parent? Am I being a good enough activist? Am I being a good enough citizen, mother, wife, daughter, sibling? And sometimes feeling like I'm not hitting the mark in any category, but also then sort of reflecting on, well, but is it that I don't need to be at 100%? You know, it is good enough to be this X, Y, and also to get my workout in, because that's part of my own mental sanity and not feeling guilty about that, or going away for a night with my husband, or going on a date night and not feeling like guilty about the other things I'm not doing at that moment. And so I think the balance and acceptance of what I feel like sometimes is failure, but is actually succeeding as best I can where I'm at, is always going to be a work in progress.
Yeah.
And just that sort of like permission of imperfection, and really accepting that and understanding it versus just saying it.
Mm. I love that Steinbeck quote, "Don't let the perfect be the enemy of the good."
Yes.
And just the other day I was listening to a conversation between Elizabeth Gilbert and Glennon Doyle. And Liz Gilbert quoted a friend, and I wish I could remember who she said this, but that also being inspired by that Steinbeck quote, her friend said, "Now that I don't have to be good, I can be free." And I was like, oh my God. It made me feel like I had been electrocuted in the best way, and also made me want to cry. And I was like, that's what it is.
Yeah.
You know, to give yourself the freedom just to be, and to not always feel like you have to measure up or hit a standard or do the right thing or be the best activist or the best wife or the best mom or the best, just to be in whatever moment you're in. That sounds really nice to me.
Yeah. And it's my own standards. You know, yeah. It's nobody else's, but I'm also, and everyone is their own harshest critic. So my standards are going to be like way above
I always think like when I'm getting trolled on the internet, I'm like, you guys think you're cute. No one's meaner to me than me.
Yeah, I know.
It just doesn't work that way.
Right.
So it's interesting how we have to learn to live with that inner standard setter.
100%. And try to set that example for my own kids.
Yeah.
You know, so.
Very cool. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
Whip Smarties, it's no secret to any of you that this is an election year. And as we've talked about on this podcast, elections are, first of all, incredibly important to participate in. Second of all, basically make you feel like an intellectual superhero. And third of all, can be kind of complicated. One of the things we've discussed on this podcast is what voter suppression looks like today. And that's why I want to talk to you guys about I Am a Voter. It is a civic engagement organization that I helped to co-found. It is nonpartisan. It is incredibly easy to access. And one of the things we're trying to do is make sure that first-time voters have all the information they need, and that everyone who believes they're already registered isn't going to wind up finding out they've been purged from the voter rolls when they get to the voting booth. So whether you're a first-time voter or a long-time voter, let's make sure you're registered and have all the resources you need. To do that, we created the easiest ever text line for you. Text the word VOTER, V-O-T-E-R, VOTER, to 26797. We can get you registered to vote in under 2 minutes, check your registration, make sure you know where your polling place is because sometimes they change, and give you any other information that you need. So again, that's I Am a Voter, and just text the word VOTER to 26797. This show is executive produced by me, Sophia Bush, and Sim Sarna. Our supervising producer is Allison Bresnick. Our associate producer is Caitlin Lee. Our editor is Josh Windisch. And our music was written by Jack Garrett and produced by Mark Foster. This show is brought to you by Cloud 10 and Brilliant Anatomy, powered by Simplecast.